This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is the Washington Post for Friday, May 3rd, 2024. I'm Drew Logan. I'll be reading from the front section of the paper. Biden calls for peace following major clashes on prominent campuses. This is an article by Patrick Zvitek, Maham Javed, Ben Brash, and Justin Juvenal. After tumultuous pro-Palestinian protests and sizable arrests at prominent campuses on the East and West Coast, President Biden on Thursday forcefully urged demonstrators to remain peaceful in his first extensive statements on the unrest that has swept universities nationwide. Biden decried the tactics and violence seen on some campuses while supporting the rights of students to make their voices heard. "We've all seen the images," Biden said. "Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law." The unscheduled remarks were Biden's most comprehensive yet on the 2 weeks of contagious pro-Palestinian demonstrations disrupting college life in many parts of the country. They come as former President Donald Trump and other Republicans seize on the escalating clashes to depict the United States as out of control. "These are radical left lunatics," Trump told reporters Thursday morning. "They got to be stopped now because it's going to go on and it's going to get worse and worse." Biden has rejected the idea of sending the National Guard to campuses as some Republican lawmakers have called for. But in his comments Thursday, he strongly condemned anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, as well as anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian rhetoric. "The protests have put to the test two fundamental American principles," Biden said. "The first is the right to free speech and for people to peacefully assemble and make their voices heard. The second is the rule of law. Both must be upheld." The White House denied that Biden was reacting to political pressure in his remarks. The brief statement at the White House came as the number of arrests of protesters surged past 2,000. Following sweeps in which police used stun grenades to clear an encampment at UCLA and arrested dozens at campuses across the country, including a 65-year-old professor at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. The University of Minnesota reached an initial agreement to end the pro-Palestinian encampment there, but clashes continued in other parts of the country. Video showed a chaotic scene at UCLA on Thursday as police officers clad in body armor fired stun grenades, flattened tents, and arrested students before dawn at an encampment of hundreds calling for the university to divest from Israel. At one point, protesters appeared to shoot a fire extinguisher at officers, sending up a white cloud. Authorities said more than 130 were arrested on the campus. Matt Burrito, a professor of Chicano Studies and Political Science at UCLA, said he was among about 25 faculty and staff members who were standing with students. He said he saw officers fire beanbag guns at protesters. "Once again, we will find ourselves teaching this moment in our classes," Burrito said. "We were there to protect the students, but once again there was violence." UCLA officials did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the arrests. "Our community is in deep pain. We are reeling from days of violence and division," UCLA Chancellor Jean D. Block wrote in a statement Thursday. "And we hope with all of our hearts that we can return to a place where our students, faculty, and staff feel safe and one day connected again." The union representing more than 48,000 University of California system academic workers is weighing when to vote on a possible strike over UCLA's handling of protests. "This is a fluid situation, and this is all moving pretty quickly," said Raphael Jame, co-president of UAW Local 4811, adding that the union is in dialogue with the university and encouraging UCLA to do everything it can to de-escalate the situation. The union's leadership voted Wednesday morning to hold a strike authorization vote as early as next week, saying UC management must change course. Any strike would cause a significant disruption to research and instruction throughout the UC system, James said. UAW Local 4811 represents graduate students, postdocs, and other academic workers who serve the system year-round but does not include faculty. Thousands of miles away on the East Coast, police and pro-Palestinian protesters squared off at Dartmouth College early Thursday. Dartmouth history professor Annalise Orlek said she was among the 90 protesters arrested, describing in a telephone interview Thursday how police pushed her to the ground, knelt on her back, and fastened her hands in zip ties after she and other members of the faculty formed a protective cordon around student protesters. Orlek, 65, said she was charged with criminal trespass and is forbidden from entering Dartmouth's campus as a condition of her bail. Video showed Orlek confronting officers before she was taken to the ground. "Brutal is the word that I'm using. It was punitive," she said. "I told them I'm 65 years old. I'm old enough to be your mother." Dartmouth officials did not directly address the claims of police violence, but Dartmouth President Sion Leah Belock said in a statement that the stand protesters took has consequences. "People felt so strongly about their beliefs that they were willing to face disciplinary action and arrest," Belock wrote in a statement. "While there is bravery in that, part of choosing to engage in this way is not just acknowledging but accepting that actions have consequences." Yale students also said police violently assaulted people carrying out a peaceful protest on the campus Wednesday night. In a statement from students and community members, protesters said the university police arrested two people without giving the group any warnings. Officers, according to the protest group, then tackled protesters, slammed their faces into the ground, and shoved and grabbed people. The university confirmed that two students and two non-students had been arrested Wednesday night, but said the students had been warned before the arrest. The university did not respond to specific allegations from the student group. The group refused to disperse after repeated warnings from the Yale Police Department that they were violating university policies by occupying parts of the campus without permission, said Karen Pert with Yale's media office. There were also a number of arrests and other clashes across the country Thursday. The Portland Police Bureau arrested 12 people, including four students at Portland State University in Oregon, as they cleared a library occupied by protesters since Monday. 12 people, including 10 students, were arrested at the University of New Hampshire. Tanya D. Lazuriaga, a spokeswoman for the university, said Thursday. Those arrested by UNH police are charged with disorderly conduct and trespassing. The crackdowns troubled some lawmakers. Members of the Arizona State Senate and House Democratic Caucus wrote to university officials across the state urging them to rescind harsh punishment for protesters and expressing alarm that students were brutalized by police on some campuses during protests. "It is essential you do not undermine the principles of academic freedom and free speech," the caucus wrote. The U.S. House on Wednesday passed a bill aimed at empowering the federal government to crack down on campus protests by codifying a definition of anti-Semitism that encompasses not just threats against Jews, but also against certain criticisms of Israel itself, but the road ahead in the Senate could be longer. Senate Majority Leader Charles E. Schumer, a Democrat from New York, told reporters Thursday that Senate leaders had conducted hotlines polling the members of both parties to see whether the Senate would be able to pass the House bill through unanimous consent, avoiding a lengthy procedure and debate. "But there are objections on both sides," Schumer said, "so we're going to look for the best way to move forward, leaving the door open to a possible vote and potentially lengthy Senate debate on the matter later this month." There were moments of calm amid the clashes. The University of Minnesota reached an initial agreement to end the pro-Palestinian encampment on campus, according to interim president Jeff Ettinger. "While there is more work to do and conversations are still planned with other student groups affected by the painful situation in Palestine, I am heartened by today's progress," Ettinger wrote in a note to encampment organizers late Wednesday evening. "While we do not condone tactics that are outside of our policies, we appreciate student leaders' willingness to engage in dialogue." U.S. forces thought they killed a terrorist. They got the wrong man. This is an article by Alex Horton and Meg Kelly. A U.S. drone strike in Syria last year killed a 56-year-old shepherd after confusing him for a terrorist leader. An internal investigation concluded, underscoring the Pentagon's persistent struggle to avoid unintentional casualties, despite the Biden administration's pledge to curb such incidents. The new assessment by U.S. Central Command, which oversees American military activity throughout the Middle East, affirms a Washington Post investigation published a year ago that cast doubt on officials' initial public claim to have slain a senior al-Qaeda figure. A summary of the investigation's findings was released Thursday. Lotfi Hassan Misto was tending to his animals on May 3, 2023, in Korkanya, a rural town in northwestern Syria. Above, his movements were being tracked by an armed Predator drone when U.S. forces fired a Hellfire missile into the rocky outcrop behind him. Commanders had confidence they were attacking a terrorist, official said afterwards. Instead, a defense official said this week, the suspected militant who had been their target slipped away and remains at large. The investigation determined U.S. forces misidentified the intended al-Qaeda target and that a civilian was struck and killed instead, officials wrote. In the investigation summary, which identifies Misto by name, he was the sole fatality, along with several of his sheep, according to video captured by first responders at the scene. Thursday's announcement offers little additional insight into how U.S. commanders and analysts botched the strike, saying only that it was conducted in compliance with the law of armed conflict as well as Department of Defense and CENTCOM policies. The military's investigation was opened about a month after the Post published the investigation on May 18th of last year. Many of the facts and findings are classified and cannot be shared public, Thursday's announcement said. For that reason, officials said they are unable to answer several questions about the investigation. In 2022, after years of scrutiny, the Pentagon said it would work toward reducing such incidents and increasing transparency when they do occur. The changes enacted early in the Biden administration were prompted by numerous investigations by the news media and other independent watchdogs that revealed how flawed intelligence and a lack of clear-eyed analysts contributed to civilian deaths that were later minimized or excused away within the Department of Defense and White House. The defense official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss aspects of the investigation ahead of Thursday's announcement, said the military's review showed that the botched drone strike was the result of confirmation bias and insufficient red teaming, a term the Defense Department uses for personnel tasked with stress testing the decision-making during such operations to ensure their accuracy. The investigation revealed several issues that could be improved, the command added, without providing specifics. We are committed to learning from this incident and improving our targeting processes to mitigate potential civilian harm. The investigation was prepared by a one-star general who was assisted by 10 senior service members and civilians with relevant experience but who were not involved in the deadly strike, Central Command said. The work included interviews with more than 40 witnesses, and it sought information from non-governmental organizations. It is unclear if any of the witnesses interviewed were civilians. The investigation was completed in November. Officials did not explain why its findings were withheld until now. The dearth of information disclosed by the military makes it difficult to assess if U.S. personnel acted recklessly in this case, said Una Hathaway, an international law professor at Yale Law School. Yet the contours of the strike are similar to past incidents, she said, pointing to misidentification as a common factor in attacks that end in civilian bloodshed. Such errors are not necessarily unlawful, she said, but a pattern of recklessness in targeting could be considered a violation of international humanitarian law. The U.S. government doesn't do enough to learn from its mistakes, she said, citing her research on other U.S. airstrikes. the exact same mistakes happen over and over and over again. U.S. personnel monitoring the area near Misto's home relied on various sources, including intercepts and human intelligence, that led them to conclude that the residential compound was the area in which the targeted individual was located, the defense official said. We had been tracking Misto for some time under the belief that he was the target, the defense official said. Neighbors told the Post last year that such aircraft had circulated for about 2 weeks. Several issues remain unclear, including who the intended target was, how he was able to evade U.S. forces, whether this failure allowed him to resume his suspected terrorist activities, and vitally, how U.S. personnel watching Misto never realized that he was the wrong man. It is also unclear whether anyone will be held accountable for the deadly mistake. Priyanka Motaparthy, director of the Project on Armed Conflict, Terrorism and Human Rights at Columbia Law School, said the military appears to have conducted a far more robust investigation than others in recent years, but the response, she said, is inadequate. In every case, we hear there was an unfortunate mistake, she said, noting that the confusion between Misto and the target was particularly troubling. There's a legal requirement to have in place procedural safeguards to prevent acting on faulty intelligence and targeting the wrong person. The fundamental right to life is at stake. Misto spent his life in Idlib province, where he married and started a large family of 12 children, 8 daughters and 4 sons, whom he supported with work as a brickmaker. He tended to sheep and chickens, staying close to home except when visiting his mosque. A terrorist life was preposterous, his family told the Post, for a man whose priority outside work and prayer was sipping tea with loved ones steps away from where he was killed. The U.S. government typically provides funds known as ex gratia, or condolence payments, for survivors of civilians killed in military operations. The Misto family will not receive a payment, a U.S. official said, citing concerns that such funds could make their way to a terrorist organization. This official spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal deliberations about the incident. The military should seek information on what, if any, forms of amends would interest the family while setting appropriate expectations about the likelihood, said Joanna Naples Mitchell, an attorney previously in touch with Misto's family, and the redress program director at the Zomnia Center, a humanitarian nonprofit. Making a decision without this information fails to fully dignify their losses. Central Command's statement is commendable in its admission of responsibility and pledge to learn from the strike, Naples Mitchell said, but she described the Pentagon's immediate and sustained assertions of Misto's link to terrorism as harmful. In the future, the Department of Defense should take care not to make prejudicial statements regarding civilian status once an investigation has been opened, she said in the statement. In this case, such statements did further harm to a family that was already grieving the loss of a father, brother, and breadwinner. This, too, should be a lesson learned. Apple, Google, and Venmo fight new U.S. plan to monitor payment apps. This is an article by Tony Rahm. The U.S. government is weighing whether to treat Apple, Google, and PayPal-owned Venmo more like banks and regularly inspect some of their operation, in a move meant to protect millions of Americans who now use their smartphones to pay at the register and send money to family and friends. But the prospect of heightened federal oversight has sparked deep and wide-ranging unease throughout the tech industry, triggering a lobbying offensive that aims to limit the government's power to monitor mobile wallets, accounts, or other digital payment services. The spats have occurred with little fanfare on Capitol Hill and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, which unveiled its proposal for new tech scrutiny in November. The agency seeks to subject the largest payment apps and services, from money transferring tools like Cash App, for example, to the smartphone wallets offered by Apple and Google, to the same rigorous checkups as their bricks and mortar predecessors. In practice, the CFPB would gain the ability to conduct on-site reviews at these companies and examine their private documents and communications, a form of monitoring known as supervision, meant to ensure the stewards of Americans' money have sound financial practices. Major banks such as Bank of America, Chase, and Wells Fargo are already subject to such federal inspections. The CFPB has portrayed its proposal as a response to rising complaints from smartphone users who say they struggle to resolve fraudulent charges, restore missing balances, and address myriad other troubles with many popular digital payment services. While the agency's rules are not final, regulators have also explored ways to invoke their existing authorities so that they can inspect select tech companies on a case-by-case basis, according to two people familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the confidential rule-writing process. But the tech industry has been unsparing in its opposition, arguing there is no proof that the products harm consumers. An executive at the lobbying group TechNet, which represents Apple, Google, and PayPal, told lawmakers at a congressional hearing in March that the government's proposal is legally defective. Other tech lobbyists have expressed fears that the CFPB stands to gain unprecedented access to their businesses, potentially enabling the government to open probes and levy punishments if it finds misconduct, even outside of payment apps. The fierce resistance suggests the tech industry would sooner sue the CFPB than submit to greater federal oversight of digital payments, foreshadowing yet another rift between government regulators and the tech and financial heavyweights under their watch. These are not services that a few people are using. These are products that are becoming almost a standard part of how people transact, so it's pretty urgent, said Adam Rust, Director of Financial Services at the Consumer Federation of America, which has encouraged the CFPB to act. There's widespread use and systemic inconsistency in oversight. Apple, Google, and PayPal each declined to comment. Carl Holzhauser, Executive Vice President at TechNet, said the organization does not oppose federal oversight, but he said the CFPB wrote its rules so broadly that small and medium-sized businesses could face unnecessary inspections too. I think the CFPB's intent is to have a much wider regulatory purview, which will give them the ability to regulate all of the tech industry, he said. Rohit Chopra, the director of CFPB, said in a statement that the agency's proposed rules would ensure large payment companies of all types get the appropriate oversight, adding, families should get the same consumer protections regardless of whether their payments are handled by a Wall Street bank or a Silicon Valley tech giant. The new scrutiny in Washington reflects the rapid sea change in the way Americans spend cash. Mobile wallets like Apple Pay are now commonplace, and peer-to-peer money transfer apps, including Venmo, have experienced a meteoric rise over the past decade. An estimated 159 million Americans made such transactions in 2023, according to data from eMarketer, which projects that just under 75% of all smartphone owners will use such tools by 2027. Spanning a vast array of services, payment apps, and platforms are regulated by a patchwork of laws, from state money transfer licenses to federal rules that govern deposits, data, and consumer disputes. While some states already supervise tech companies, the extent of their reviews and the nature of their enforcement efforts can vary dramatically across the country, according to Christopher Odinette, a law professor at the University of Iowa who specializes in consumer finance. These regulators, they come in many different shapes and sizes, he said, noting some have really thin staffs and really lean budgets. But the tech companies that offer these products are not banks, so they may not receive the same federal scrutiny as other financial institutions, even when their offerings are indistinguishable to the average consumer. If a user were to store money in their account on PayPal, for example, that cash isn't always federally insured, whereas a traditional bank deposit would be guaranteed by the government and regulated accordingly. Citing these disparities, the CFPB issued rules in November meant to subject tech giants to tougher oversight. The agency proposed supervising the largest digital consumer payment companies, those with more than 5 million transactions annually, to ensure they follow federal laws, including those that prohibit deceptive practices and protect consumers' data. With more aggressive monitoring, the CFPB said, it could more easily spot the and address violations because the supervision process empowers the government to seek changes to companies' practices or take legal action. The agency's plan arrived roughly 2 years after Chopper ordered some of the companies, same companies, to turn over data related to their payment apps. The traditional lines we drew within the financial sector have become fuzzy over the past several decades, Chopper said in a speech before the proposed rules were released. Big tech companies are now taking advantage of that blurring as they move into finance, threatening the fundamental separation between banking, money, and payments on one side and our real economy on the other. While the agency did not identify companies it would target, officials estimate that about 17 digital payment services would be subject to enhanced oversight. But the tech industry fiercely rebuked the idea, saying the CFPB would saddle a much wider array of products and services with costly, unnecessary scrutiny. In January, lobbyists for Block, which owns Cash App, and for other services, including Venmo, told the government its proposal is without justification and conflates many types of apps and services. Some criticisms echoed the complaints the company tended to levy at the CFPB before suing, though the leader of the group said it was too soon to comment on next steps. Knowing the atmosphere, I wouldn't be surprised if someone doesn't legally challenge this rule, said Penny Lee, the president of the Financial Technology Association. Many financial technology companies faulted the CFPB for rules that could ultimately cover more companies than portrayed, as many as 180, according to TechNet's Holzhauser, who blasted it as a power grab to regulate. Lobbyists for some of the most popular cryptocurrencies, crypto wallet services, and their investors, meanwhile, told the CFPB it had no authority over their industry. Some of the largest tech companies, including Apple, Amazon, and Google, also flagged the significant costs they would face under greater federal oversight. Speaking through one of their top Washington voices, the Computer and Communications Industry Association, they fretted that CFPB would gain unprecedented visibility into their inner workings. The tech giants said that the rules would allow the agency to supervise and examine other activities, even outside of payment apps, potentially opening the door for other federal investigations and punishments. Already, Apple, Amazon, and Google are facing separate federal lawsuits that accuse them of violating antitrust laws, and all three companies have been sanctioned or faced complaints related to their handling of consumers' data. In its own filing, Amazon told the CFPB it shouldn't be covered by the new rules at all, arguing that there are no consumer risks with tools like its Amazon Pay service, which helps users pay for goods on other merchants' websites and doesn't store consumers' cash. Amazon founder and former chief executive Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. The lobbying campaign stands in stark contrast to the thousands of complaints filed in recent years by aggrieved consumers who have consistently told the CFPB that tech companies mishandle their money. Some have sought federal help after they struggled to resolve unauthorized charges on Venmo, for example. Others have asked the Bureau for aid when they couldn't get the attention of Cash App about fraud or other issues affecting their balances. Some of the accusations have sparked CFPB probes. The agency opened an investigation in 2022 into Block over its handling of customer complaints and disputes, the company later told its investors. In February, the parent company of Cash App said regulators are now considering recommending that the CFPB take legal action. A spokesperson declined to comment for this article. "We've seen a lot of problems," said Lauren Saunders, an associate director at the National Consumer Law Center, which has advocated for agency action. We've seen consumers facing a lot of fraud in payments, a lot of trouble reaching customer service, a lot of trouble getting their accounts unfrozen. Consumer groups largely have heralded the CFPB's approach, as have state officials who encouraged the agency this year to adopt rules that might aid their own investigations. Matthew Platkin, the Attorney General of New Jersey, said in an interview that he led a coalition of 19 states in asking the CFPB to intervene after seeing a significant increase in risk our residents face when using a whole host of apps, especially when it comes to mobile transactions. Even before the CFPB finalizes rules, however, the agency can begin supervising the most high-risk companies under its founding law. Chopra first announced that the CFPB would revise this dormant authority in 2022, citing the rapid growth of consumer offerings by non-banks, and they need to ensure they are held to the same standards as their financial counterparts. Much of this work tends to occur in secret unless companies reveal they are under supervision or the CFPB places an uncooperative firm under a legal order. It has implemented such reviews for at least one fintech company, Affirm, which offers a buy now, pay later service that helps people obtain short-term loans for large purchases. The company disclosed the scrutiny last year in filings with investors. We have always viewed the CFPB as one of our regulators, which is why we have continuously engaged with them, as well as of our other regulatory stakeholders, Affirm spokesman Matt Gross said in a statement. Other technology companies have been more averse to greater federal oversight, choosing to take their complaints to Congress, where Republicans have long sided with industry in seeking to rein in or eliminate entirely the CFPB. The political dynamic was on display last month as House GOP leaders convened a hearing to explore the agency's latest action to restrict competition in payments, primarily calling tech lobbyists, lawyers, and allies to testify. Republicans thrashed the CFPB for pursuing what they called unnecessary regulation. Representative French Hill, a Republican from Arkansas, the top lawmaker on the House's leading fintech-focused committee, said the CFPB's rules would give it carte blanche to knock down the door of companies large and small with their fleet of examiners. The CFPB is trying to cast as wide of a net as possible and become a technology regulator, he said. Many of the GOP attacks mimicked complaints levied by technology companies, which have donated to Hill and other panel lawmakers, according to federal records reviewed by Open Secrets, a money and politics watchdog. We have to protect consumers and safeguard them, TechNet's Holzhauer told lawmakers during the hearing, but onerous regulations like this will have a chilling effect on innovation. Biden expands two California national monuments crucial to tribes. This is an article by Maxine Joselau. President Biden on Thursday expanded the boundaries of two national monuments in California by nearly 120,000 acres, using his executive authority to protect vast swaths of land of cultural significance to Native American tribes and nearby communities. During a ceremony in the Oval Office, Biden signed two proclamations enlarging the San Gabriel Mountains National Monument and the Berryessa Snow Mountain National Monument, both of which were originally designated by President Barack Obama. The Washington Post first reported last month that the proclamations were imminent. The San Gabriel Mountains National Monument, east of Los Angeles, encompasses roughly 346,000 acres, mostly in the Angeles National Forest. Its trails offer stunning mountain vistas for hikers, mountain bikers, and campers. It will grow by 105,919 acres under Biden's plan. The Berryessa Snow Mountain Monument, northwest of Sacramento, covers nearly 331,000 acres of oak-studded hillsides and steep canyons. In the summer, its trails explode with vibrant wildflowers. The proclamation will expand the site by 13,696 acres. Senator Alex Padilla, a Democrat of California, and Representative Judy Chu, a Democrat from California, have championed legislation to enlarge the San Gabriel Mountains National Monument, but the measure has stalled in the divided Congress. Biden used his executive authority under the 1906 Antiquities Act to bypass the gridlock on Capitol Hill. What a momentous day for Angelenos, Chu said in a statement, adding that the proclamation follows decades of advocacy by a vibrant, diverse coalition of indigenous leaders, community activists, and nature lovers. Padilla said in an interview that the expansion will benefit thousands of low-income families in the Los Angeles area who lack access to other green spaces. It's strengthening access to the outdoors for so many low-income working families in the greater Los Angeles area, Padilla said. I think it's about 15 million people in the Los Angeles area who are within a 90-minute drive of the San Gabriel Mountains. The mountains are only an hour's drive from East Los Angeles, which is 95.5% Hispanic or Latino, according to census data. Olivia Juarez, public land program director at Green Latinos, an advocacy group, called the expansion the biggest success for Latino communities' conservation priorities that has gotten done by the Biden administration. Rudy J. Ortega Jr., tribal president of the Fernandiano Tataviam Band of Mission Indians, said he had worried that industrial development would encroach on lands near the San Gabriel Mountains that his people have cared for since time immemorial. The expansion, he said in a statement, would also further protect areas that are critical for our environment and the wildlife and plants that depend on this landscape. The Yoka, Dihi, Winton Nation, and other tribes helped lead the campaign to expand the Berryessa Snow Mountain National Monument. They called for adding 13,753 acres and changing the name of an additional 11-mile ridgeline from Walker Ridge to Moloch Luyuk, which means Condor Ridge in the Patwin language. Moloch Luyuk and surrounding lands are part of the ancestral homeland of the Hill Patwin people. Condors once soared in the skies there, but their population has declined because of lead poisoning, habitat destruction, and poaching. The area is also home to bald eagles, tule elk, mountain lions, and other species. Representatives John Garamendi, a Democrat from California, and Mike Thompson, a Democrat from California, have led legislation to enlarge the Berryessa Snow Mountain National Monument and allow for tribal co-management of the site. The presidential proclamation will officially rename the additional ridgeline Moloch Luyuk and will direct the Interior Department to explore co-stewardship of the area with tribal nations, according to a White House fact sheet. The proclamation honors the years of effort that tribes have invested in protecting the land of our ancestors and will reflect a commitment on the part of the administration and the Bureau of Land Management to build stronger relationships with California tribes that will ultimately benefit all California residents. Anthony Roberts, tribal chairman of the Yoka, Dihi, Winton Nation, said in a statement. Biden has set an ambitious goal of conserving 30% of America's lands and waters by 2030, and he has previously designated five new national monuments. Most recently, the president in August created the Bajnwaho Itak Kukveni National Monument near the Grand Canyon, safeguarding the site from new uranium mining. Conservation groups, tribes, and Democratic lawmakers have praised these actions while calling for more. Many have urged Biden to designate more than 1 million acres of wilderness in southeastern Oregon as the Owyhee Canyonlands National Monument and to designate 627,855 acres of desert in Southern California as the Chuckwalla National Monument. Padilla said he has spoken with administration officials about Chuckwalla and remains optimistic about the possible designation. We've been in touch, and they've given us some positive signals, he said. We know it's a process. Biden is spending another $3 billion to place lead pipes. Some experts say it's not enough. This is an article by Amadalat Ajaysa. The Biden administration announced Thursday that it will start distributing an additional $3 billion to communities across the country to replace lead pipes, part of a massive push to overhaul the nation's drinking water system. The allotment is the latest round of money promised under the bipartisan infrastructure law, which is scheduled to dole out $15 billion to states over 5 years to update the country's aged infrastructure and eliminate lead service pipes. There are two more scheduled installments under President Biden's plan, which has to date allocated $9 billion, enough to replace up to 1.7 million lead pipes, the administration said. There's no safe level of exposure to lead, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It can cause developmental delays, difficulty learning, and behavioral problems. Even low-level exposure can cause permanent cognitive damage, especially in developing children, and it disproportionately harms Black and low-income families. The announcement comes just a week after the 10th anniversary of the start of the Flint water crisis in Michigan, which triggered national alarm about the dangers of lead in America's drinking water. Still, the White House estimates that there are more than 9 million lead pipes in the United States. Biden, who has said his administration wants to replace every lead pipe in the country within the next decade, will announce the distributions Thursday in Wilmington, North Carolina. President Biden understands it is critical to identify and remove lead pipes as quickly as possible, and he has secured significant resources for states and territories to accelerate the permanent removal of dangerous lead pipes once and for all, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Michael Regan said during a call with reporters. The impact of lead exposure is irreversible, and some doubt that funding from the infrastructure law will be enough to adequately address the issue on its own. The EPA has said that replacing the roughly 9 million lead pipes that supply U.S. homes with drinking water could cost $45 billion or more. It's the biggest investment in U.S. history for water infrastructure and the biggest investment in U.S. history for lead pipe removal, but it's not going to be enough. There's still going to need to be additional funding, said Eric Olson, a senior strategic director for health and food at the National Resources Defense Council, an advocacy group. Olson said he believes it will need to be a shared responsibility among local, state, and federal governments to cover the rest of the costs of lead pipe replacement once infrastructure law funding runs out, in addition to local water utilities. The problem was really created in large part by the water utilities themselves, who generally required lead pipes to be used, so it's important that utilities also foot the bill, Olson said. Under the proposed EPA rule, all water utilities are required to provide inventory of their lead pipes by October 16th. If passed, the rule will require all lead pipes to be removed over the next decade by utilities. Lead pipes were installed in cities decades ago because they were cheaper and more flexible, but the pipes wear down and corrode. Lead can leach into drinking water. Congress banned their installation in 1986. The infrastructure law distributes different amounts of money to all 50 states and every U.S. territory to address lead pipes. Illinois, Florida, and Ohio are receiving the largest allotments, totaling nearly $654 million in the new round of funding. Once the money is distributed, it is up to each state to decide how to spend the funds and distribute them to cities. There are more than 250 lead service line replacement programs through various water utilities across the nation, according to data compiled by the Environmental Defense Fund. Sharon Hyde, a Memphis housing program manager for the National Group Green and Healthy Homes Initiative, said the distribution process doesn't guarantee that communities will get the money, leaving the most at risk relying on their municipalities to apply for the funding on their behalf. I wish that this money came down the pipeline by entitled entitlement funds to the communities that need the money the worst, that have the oldest housing stock, that have high levels of lead in the water, and that are disproportionately low income, Hyde said. Hyde said she worries that without local prioritization, some water utilities may not apply for funds, while other more proactive companies will get a bigger slice of the pie when they may not need it. Trump trial takeaways. When in doubt, steer clear. This is an article by Perry Stein and Devlin Barrett. Another day in Manhattan criminal court with much more testimony about the messy, shady world of celebrities and tabloid media. But unlike the last week and a half, Donald Trump's legal team tried to use the tabloid stories Thursday to go on offense rather than playing defense against the prosecutor's allegations. New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan started the day with a hearing to determine if Trump had again violated the court-imposed gag order. Later, when one of Trump's lawyers asked whether it would be okay for her client to post articles about the case on social media, the judge seemed extremely skeptical. "I think the best advice to give your client is, when in doubt, steer clear," he said. Here are the main Thursday takeaways from the state of New York's case against Trump, with help from her colleagues Shana Jacobs and Mark Berman in New York. A refresher, Trump is accused of falsifying business documents when he classified a reimbursement he made to his lawyer as a legal fee rather than a payment associated with his campaign. The lawyer paid hush money to keep adult film actress Stormy Daniels quiet during the 2016 election about a sexual encounter she said she had with Trump. Judge seems to be losing patience with Trump's potential gag violations. Trump has complained that the gag order is stifling his protected political speech as he is running his presidential campaign. The order bars him from commenting on witnesses, jurors, prosecutors, or family members of the judge and the Manhattan District Attorney. Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, debated with Merchan about whether Trump may respond to President Biden's reference to Daniels in a joke at the White House Correspondents Association dinner last week. Biden said in his speech that Trump recently had some tough days with stormy weather. Blanche suggested that Trump should be allowed to mention Daniels in his retort. Merchan made clear that Trump is free to speak about his main political opponent, Biden, all he wants, but he cannot speak about witnesses in the trial. "You're saying that he can't respond to attacks by President Biden without saying Stormy Daniels," the judge asked skeptically. "He's certainly allowed to respond to something that's said by President Biden. There's nothing in the gag order that says he can't." Merchan ruled Tuesday that Trump had violated the gag order 9 times, warning that the former president could land in jail if the violations continue. At the start of court Thursday, he held another hearing on an additional 4 violations prosecutors alleged last week. He could rule at any time. Much of Thursday was spent with Trump's lawyers cross-examining Keith Davidson, a Los Angeles lawyer who represented Daniels and negotiated the hush money payments from former Trump attorney Michael Cohen. When prosecutors questioned Davidson, they aimed to use his testimony to boost their claim that Trump and his team orchestrated payments to women with whom the presidential candidate was alleged to have had affairs, and they did so to keep the damaging stories quiet ahead of the 2016 election. The defense team had a very different story to tell of a sleazy and opportunistic tabloid industry trying to shake down a celebrity businessman turned presidential candidate ahead of the 2016 election. Trump's attorney, Emil Bove, suggested that Davidson's action was borderline extortion. Bove brought up Davidson's efforts to get money from his other clients from other famous people, including actor Charlie Sheen and wrestler Hulk Hogan, aiming to show the jury that the Los Angeles attorney has a history of making money off celebrities' damaging stories. Davidson told jurors that Cohen had grand aspirations when Trump won the presidency. He hoped to be tapped as the White House chief of staff or maybe even U.S. attorney general, But Trump did not find a role in the administration for his longtime fixer, Davidson testified under cross-examination. Around that time, Cohen called Davidson despondent and complaining about how much he had done for Trump over the years. I thought he was going to kill himself, Davidson said. The defense probably wanted to highlight this testimony to show that Cohen desperately wanted Trump to win the election and had his own incentives to bury the story of the alleged tryst with Daniels. Prosecutors must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Trump was involved in the hush money payments and that they were intended to influence the election results. The defense team, in turn, is trying to prove that any election-related hush money payment is all on Cohen, not Trump. Davidson spent hours and hours testifying about how he brokered deals to get Cohen to pay Daniels. He told jurors he believed that Trump's team wanted these stories buried because they thought they would damage his reputation among voters. But it seems he never expected Trump to actually become president. On the stand Thursday, Davidson described his shock as he watched the 2016 election results. What have we done? He texted a National Enquirer editor who had been involved in the hush money discussions. Oh my God, the editor replied. On the witness stand, Davidson described the text as a bit of gallows humor. There was an understanding that our activities may in some way have assisted the presidential campaign of Donald Trump. Question time. Today's reader question, why isn't Alan H. Weisselberg, the former chief financial officer at the Trump Organization, expected to testify in this trial? Wasn't he involved in the hush money payment to Stormy Daniels? Answer, yes. Weisselberg would be a relevant witness in this case, but Weisselberg has now pleaded guilty twice to perjury, admitting to lying to investigators in two separate cases involving Trump and his company. Most lawyers would say a twice-admitted perjurer is pretty much hopeless as a witness for either side. Biden and Democrats push hard to put North Carolina in play. This is an article by Yasmin Abudaleb, Tyler Pager, and Cleve R. Wootson, Jr. President Biden visited North Carolina on Thursday at a time when his campaign is investing heavily in the state and building a robust electoral operation there far earlier than it did in 2020, a reflection of Democrats' belief that they can make a credible run at winning North Carolina despite losing it to Donald Trump 4 years ago. Biden lost the state by just one percentage point in 2020, and his campaign sees a number of factors that could put the state firmly in play this year. While the campaign has focused on states Biden won in 2020 mostly and ensuring that he can repeat that victory, clinching North Carolina would provide the president an alternative path if he loses other swing states. Biden advisors see the opportunity to attract at least some of the nearly 250,000 GOP voters who cast ballots for former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in the March Republican primary, according to a Biden campaign official, speaking on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal thinking. Campaign advisors believe a highly controversial GOP candidate for governor, Mark Robinson, could help boost Democratic voter turnout. On Thursday, Biden said his bipartisan infrastructure law has hugely benefited North Carolina, including by helping replace lead pipes and improve water quality, an issue that disproportionately affects minority communities. Biden also noted that unemployment has come down on his watch and that the federal government can now negotiate the price of some drugs through Medicare. Look, my predecessor and his allies have a very different view. Every single Republican voted against the American Rescue Plan, every one of them. That's provided hundreds of millions of dollars to deliver drinking water to all of North Carolina's schools, Biden said. Still, Biden faces a number of political challenges 6 months out from the election that could erode his chances in the state. Polls show that young voters and progressives widely disapprove of the president's staunch support of Israel's military assault in Gaza. Students across the country have staged protests against the Israeli invasion that have resulted in hundreds of arrests, and Biden has faced anti-war protesters at nearly every public event for more than 6 months. Polls also show little voter enthusiasm for Biden, even among those who support him, a potentially serious problem as he works to hold together his fragile 2020 coalition. In North Carolina, Biden will have to overcome widespread economic anxiety and disapproval of his handling of a surge of migrants in the southern border. Republican and Democratic strategists said, as well as find ways to boost excitement about his candidacy. Beyond that, no Democrat has won North Carolina's 15 electoral votes since Barack Obama in 2008. Biden lost the state to Trump by nearly 75,000 votes 4 years ago. To address these hurdles, Biden is seeking to frame the election as a binary choice between him and Trump, rather than a referendum on his presidency. Biden has argued that Trump will rip away people's freedoms, including the right to reproductive health care, and end American democracy. The Biden campaign has spent tens of millions of dollars on television ads in North Carolina and other key swing states. His team expects to have 40 staffers in the state by the end of the month and will soon have 11 offices in key counties, according to the campaign official. In 2020, the campaign did not begin hiring senior staffers until June, the official said. While Biden won Georgia in 2020, his path to victory in that state looks more challenging this time around. 4 years ago, Biden was able to capitalize on two U.S. Senate races in Georgia, ultimately won by Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael J. Warnock, that determined control of the chamber and energized Democratic voters in the state. By contrast, there are no similarly high-profile down-ballot races in Georgia this year. And with that, we're just about out of time. This has been Drew Logan reading the Washington Post. Have a great weekend. We'll catch up next week.